The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Coming up, a week after Russia flexed its military muscle in Ukraine, a tense standoff remains. Warning shots have been fired, but neither side has yet blinked. Just how strong is Vladimir Putin? How should the European Union respond? Are we on the verge of a second Cold War? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland and Seamus Mill. And on the line, Mary Mendras, who's a scholar on Russia from Chatham House, who also brings a French perspective because she's been teaching in Paris. Now, as we record this, an emergency EU summit is underway to discuss the crisis in Ukraine as Russian forces continue to occupy the Crimean Peninsula. So far, no more than warning shots have been fired, but the deadlock continues. So no shots, Jonathan. Do you think the talk we're getting from some of the papers about the worst crisis in Europe since the 21st century is overdone, or do you think it's for real?
Well, I think there's a sense that perhaps things have passed that moment of absolute critical danger, because it does seem as if both sides would rather resolve this diplomatically than any other way. So there isn't that sort of intensity about it. But no, the standoff is still there, whether or not it's the greatest in, you know, human history. So far, not a shot has been fired in anger in terms of Russia and Ukraine, and so far the conflict is being addressed diplomatically. So at this stage, you've just got to think it's in the interest of both sides to try and find a way diplomatically out of this. Neither of them want to turn this into a shooting war. And so therefore, all the conversations about, you know, a contact group and dialogue, at the moment, that's where it seems to be going.
Now, Marie, much of the world has been writing this up in terms of Putin flexing his muscles and maybe a new Cold War. But you've written something about how Putin's left looking isolated and exposed and maybe in some senses weak.
Oh, yes. I think definitely the Russian president has suffered a severe blow in recent days. It's the first time since he came to power 15 years ago that there is such a wide and strong consensus in the international community against his discourse and his actions. It's not only the European Union meeting of today, but it was the UN Security Council emergency session on Monday, where all permanent members were extremely harsh in their criticism of Putin's action. It's been also NATO declarations, Council of Europe, OSCE, and all our governments. So he's really, I think he, it, I mean, he's muscle flexing, to use your term, is really backfiring.
And so it may be isolating him, but does he need lots of allies? Isn't the point maybe if he's strong enough with energy resources and with brute military power, he can have Putinism in one country?
Well, my point really is that the Russian authorities have very few real allies. You know, they've never had many. But they used to have lots of good partners, you know, like us, China. And so they may not be losing allies that they never had, but be losing very good partners in the months to come. And that's really what we're seeing. But my other point really is that I believe, you know, being a seasoned observer of Russian politics, I believe that Putin is increasingly isolated inside Russia, in Moscow, because now, you know, his elites, economic elites, political elites, and I would say maybe even military elites are concerned and worried that what he is doing may bring only negative consequences.
Now, Seamus, you've written something this morning with a very different perspective that says that the chief failure here isn't a failure on the part of Russia or Russia isolating itself, but really the weakness of Western foreign policy.
No, what I was arguing was that this is really the consequence of the way the Soviet Union broke up. And we saw it, we've seen it in other cases in Georgia, Moldova and elsewhere, where, you know, people who are happy to be minorities inside units of a bigger multinational state don't fancy being minorities in those units when they become independent states run by ethnic groups that they're not, they don't have commonality with. And so, I mean, I think, you know, we're seeing that playing out enough, and not only that, but the fact that since the end of the Cold War, the Western powers have sought to extend NATO and its economic power through the EU right up not only to the old Soviet borders, but within the former Soviet Union. And, you know, you've seen 9 former Warsaw Pact states brought into NATO, 3 former republics of the Soviet Union in NATO. And I mean, that's, I think what happened in Georgia in 2008, where in fact it was quite clear that the Georgian forces attacked Russian forces who were stationed by international agreement in contested territory. And the Russians hit back very strongly. At that time, Putin was less isolated, because I agree with Maria on only one point, which is that I think the difference with China and the BRICS over this crisis is quite significant. And it's about the importance of territorial integrity and state sovereignty. And so that didn't happen in the Georgian case, because the clearly the attack came from Georgia, which was a kind of Western client state at the time. But I think, you know, the other thing you've got to face up to that is this follows months of very large-scale protests in Ukraine, which have been sponsored and supported by the West, including some very unpleasant far-right elements, which are now in the unelected government in Kiev, which, and, you know, their first, you know, their first act was to try and remove the official status of the Russian language. There was immediate discussion of banning the Communist Party, which has 13% of the vote. You've got armed fascist gangs on the streets of Kiev occupying government buildings. In fact, the Communist Party headquarters has been taken over by a fascist gang, which is linked to one of the groups now represented in the government. The leader of the Communist Party has had his house burned down. You know, you're talking about some really quite significant violence taking place now, and disorder, which is actually directly supported by the American and European Union governments. So now, of course, that doesn't mean that it's justified for Russia to violate territorial sovereignty of Ukraine, but it puts the whole thing in, I think, a rather different context. And it's part of something which has been going on for some years. There was an attempt, if you remember, 2004, at the time of the Orange Revolution, to bring, after that, to bring Ukraine into NATO. That was seen off after Yanukovych was elected. And, you know, I think the tussle that's going on is partly about strategic power, and it's partly about Western power in Ukraine, and it's partly about the post-Soviet reality and Russia's attempt to try and, you know, reassert itself after a long period of complete decline and collapse.
Marie, what would you say about the legitimacy or otherwise of the unelected government in Kiev?
I really need to reply to this, because I strongly disagree. But first, you know, I was in Ukraine in December. I think one cannot seriously say that the Maidan protest was not a remarkable, peaceful, civilian a pro-democratic protest. I think this whole propaganda about fascist gangs, you know, coming mainly from Russian media, I mean, should not be repeated in serious Western media.
It's actually what Ukrainians are saying in Ukraine
today. If I may, to try and present the Maidan, the hundreds and thousands of people who for 3 months managed to occupy the center of the city peacefully, you know, with nobody hurt during those 3 months, and say or imply that they are extreme rightists and fascists, when they were in fact fighting a very corrupt and brutal regime, the Yanukovych regime. I think this is simply really unacceptable, because it's so far from the realities that all of us have been witnessing. And I would like to also reply to the insinuations or allusions to the fact that the Orange Revolution 9 years ago and the Maidan Revolution of this winter would have been mainly Western support for Ukraine to be in conflict with Russia. This is absolutely untrue. The Ukrainians have always said that they want to keep very good relations with Russia, but at the same time build very good relations with Europe, because they know that Europe has the recipe for Ukraine development, because Europe is a world of rule of law, peace and prosperity. And they pretty well understand that the Putin regime and Russia under Putin is not the right example to follow. And finally, I find also what was just said about Georgia 2008 so quite different from the reality.
But we don't want to go too far into Georgia, just because
it is not true. I mean, what happened in Georgia in 2006, 7 and 8 was the Russian authorities putting a lot of pressure on the Georgian government. A lot of pressure, economic embargo, military, fighting, etc., so as to push Saakashvili to make a big mistake. And what they've been doing with Kiev now, and also in Crimea, the Russians have been trying to push the new Ukrainian authorities to also make a mistake and go for some kind of war. And one has to pay tribute to the new Ukrainian authorities that they have not fallen into the trap of armed struggle.
Can I just push you on one thing, Zoë-Marie? Because obviously you've got a very, very different reading from Seamus of who's in the right, who's in the wrong here. But I wonder, is it partly that Ukraine is quite a divided country, where there's ethnic divisions, there's linguistic divisions, and different people adopt different perspectives? And I wonder if you've been talking to different people who just see things in a very different light.
Sure. Well, I think, Russians and Ukrainians are not two ethnic groups. They are two big peoples, two big nations. And it's been this way, for a few centuries, when the Russian, Ukrainian and Belarusian languages and national identities started to emerge somewhere around the 16th century. So they are not ethnic groups. What you have in Ukraine is, yes, of course, you have part of Ukraine that speaks more fluently Ukrainian and Russian, and another part more fluently Russian than Ukrainian. But what we see in opinion polls very clearly is that there is big majority of the inhabitants of Ukraine who are very attached to the full independence of their country, whether they're Russian-speaking or Ukrainian-speaking at home. So the very specificity of Crimea has been used by the Russian authorities to disturb political, peaceful development inside Ukraine. And Crimea, I mean, I guess, our listeners have heard a lot about the Crimean Peninsula in recent days. But Crimea is one province of Ukraine, and it has an autonomous republic status. So it is already a very autonomous province. It has its own budget. And for years, Moscow has really been, the military power there.
Well, thank you for all of that. Now, Jonathan, you've spent a lot of your career writing about the Middle East. And I'm just wondering, do you see echoes of some of that in what's happening in Ukraine, with different cultures and languages, if not strictly speaking, different ethnicities? And also, I wonder whether you see an echo in people say in the Middle East sometimes, or Israelis say, there's no, who's the partner for peace? In who's the person to talk to now on the Russian side of the divide in Ukraine? If even President Putin saying that Yanukovych is finished.
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't thought particularly of those parallels. That's an interesting question. It's true that Putin's press conference was very hard to follow. I mean, there was somebody who wrote an overly trenchant piece, perhaps, saying that, you know, now it's clear from the, on the strength of that press conference, Putin's lost his marbles, which was probably an exaggeration, but it was very difficult to follow in terms of coherence, because he simultaneously said Yanukovych is still the legitimate president, and then he said his career is over, and he sort of zigzagged between these two points throughout the press conference. I don't think that goes as far as saying there's no partner there. Obviously, you know, there can be dialogue, and as I said earlier, there is a kind of mutual interest both sides have in not only avoiding a shooting war, but even actually sanctions which hurt both sides because of the trading relationship, particularly between the European Union and Russia. I mean, on the sort of dispute that's been my two colleagues here have been having, I've had some sort of, you know, interest in that because, you know, people would know from things I've written before, I would not welcome by any means a group of anti-Semites and fascists being in government in Europe. And those elements in this new Ukrainian government are obviously deeply disturbing. That said, I do sense a kind of exploitative relationship by some on the pro-Russian side who are seeking to talk up that, because that obviously makes this new government seem deeply unappealing. And I was quite guided by two sets of reporting, which I think listeners might find worthwhile looking at. The first is Gabriel Gatehouse of the BBC, who investigated exactly this for BBC's Newsnight programme and found that there definitely were some right-wing and fascistic gangs on the streets, but they weren't by any means the driving force or the dominant force. So they're there, as Seamus has been arguing, but they are not the absolute, you know, the heart or the dominant, even numerically, force. So that's in favour of what Maria was arguing. And also, the other piece would be Timothy Snyder, the very, very eminent historian of Eastern Europe at Yale University, who wrote an excellent piece for the New York Review of Books, really meticulously going through how the Maidan protest began. And brought to light a reporting I didn't know, which is that the person who kicked it all off, the very first sort of protester, was Muslim, and that there were Jewish student activists and others involved in those first protests. So I think this idea of trying, and he then, you know, was trying to say that this notion that this was somehow a fascistic, an ultra-Ukrainian nationalist rebellion is not completely fair to what this was about. And I think that's also true in this notion of describing it as US-sponsored or Western-sponsored. You know, is Seamus implying that somehow the people who went to the streets are fakes, that this is, you know, astroturfing, this wasn't a real rebellion? You know, from my distance here, from my perch here and from whatever, it looked pretty real to me. I mean, yes, it's true the West are backing it, but do we think it's somehow fake, that they are just puppets and pawns of the West? I don't think that's right. And I think that's the same about many of these countries that have opted, previously part of the Warsaw Pact, have opted through, most of them through a series of elections, to now be in the European Union or in NATO. So I think, you know, it's too easy on either side to suggest that the other side is somehow ingenuine and just a prop, a fake of either the Russians or the West.
Seamus, obviously you don't like the new regime in Kiev, but how seriously do you take the point that you've made very trenchantly in other contexts, I'm thinking of Iraq or Afghanistan, about international sovereignty? Because Russia is playing a dangerous game there, isn't it, and setting a dangerous precedent.
Yeah, I mean, I think it clearly is a breach of Ukrainian sovereignty. And I think that's, you know, I think Putin's arguments, you know, in terms of international law are clearly flaky, as I've written today. Yeah. I mean, fortunately, you know, there's been actual no armed intervention in terms of shooting. You know, in terms of the multiple interventions we've seen by Western powers in this century, which have led to hundreds of thousands of people being killed. I mean, it's not remotely on that scale. And when John Kerry, you know, says that this is an outrageous aggression on a trumped-up pretext that can't be allowed to happen in the 21st century, of course, that's exactly what happened in the case of Iraq.
But you should remember that Kerry, I've thought about this when I read your comment today, Kerry ran for president against George W. Bush. He was flaky on his position because he voted for the original resolution.
Sure, sure.
But he serves a president, Obama, who is president because he opposed the war in Iraq. So to throw back at Obama and the Obama administration, but you did Iraq. They didn't do Iraq.
We're talking about in the 21st century, by far the greatest act of unprovoked aggression is the Iraq war.
I agree, but you've got a president who opposed it.
And if you let me continue, and there have been a string of interventions, also without legal backing, also without prior UN backing, that are currently going on that the Obama administration is involved in, from Afghanistan to the Libya to the constant drone wars, which have killed thousands thousands and are killing thousands today in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and so on. So obviously, you know, the idea, as Maria says, that you know, that the European Union represents peace and rule of law in international affairs when its leading members have participated in those interventions and wars, I think is just ludicrous. But clearly, there has been a breach in this case, although hopefully, fortunately, not so far a violent one. But I think, you know, you have to come back on the point about the nature of the Maidan protests. Of course, I wasn't arguing that there were not real protesters. The majority were not and have not been from the far right. The estimates I've seen is about 30% were from far right radical nationalist groups. Although I think it is quite clear that in the final confrontations, the violent confrontations between the police and the protest groups, when the violence was coming from the protester side as well, including with guns and other forms of other weapons, the right-wing groups, the far-right groups, actually became center stage. And I think that's quite widely accepted. Now, of course, I don't regard those protests as illegitimate at all. And they clearly had large-scale support. And the Yanukovych regime was an oligarchic and corrupt government, although it was elected in fair elections. But what the point I'm making is that actually the far-right groups, which openly regard as a national hero one of the leading Nazi collaborators from the Second World War who is involved in Holocaust killings, who, you know, are led by parties which are represented in the new government, which describe Ukraine as being in the grip of a Russian Jewish mafia. I mean, if that was in any other country, I think we'd be hearing a lot more about that. And, you know, to say that these right-wing groups is all Russian propaganda, I mean, just actually look at what they say themselves and what they're doing in the streets of Kiev. And I'm talking to people all this week in Kiev, and they're frightened on the streets by these groups. So, I mean, please, let's not be ridiculous about it. The other parts of the government are the same oligarchs from the other camp that were in power after the Orange Revolution. And, for example, one of its first steps has been to appoint two new governors in eastern Ukraine, who are the two of the richest people in the country, who got their money through this oligarchic larceny of the 1990s.
And that happened in Russia in a very big way, as
exactly,
you know. Roman Abramovich is a governor.
As I wrote in my piece today, that's also the case in post-Soviet Russia.
So, Mary, can I just bring you back in on one particular question? Because I know you don't share Seamus's reading of the regime in Kiev.
But I'd be interested to know how people react to these people from Svoboda, for example, being in the government, or the right sector, being the deputy head of the National Security Council. The right sector that is involved in these anti-Semitic and extreme fascistic discourse and actions. What's the answer to that? I'd be very interested to hear how people who support this government feel about that.
Do comment on that, Marie, but can I just ask you one specific thing, which is, what about, because I haven't seen this contested, that there was talk about reducing the status of Russian as a language, which a large number of people speak, and surely that's troubling.
Yes, well, you know, first, France refused to fight in Iraq, so I guess I feel a little more comfortable.
But not in Afghanistan, Libya, Mali.
But I may feel, but I feel a little more comfortable saying that discussing today George Bush's infamous interventions, but not saying that what happened in Crimea is Russian intervention in a province of Ukraine without any legitimate request for the so-called protection of population that was not at all at threat. I think one needs to say intervention this one time was Russian action. The second point is that it is our political and diplomatic reaction, European, North American, but also from other countries, that actually stopped the bloodshed on Maidan on the 21st of February, and that it is again the political diplomacy that has forced Putin to step back from going, you know, any further. And now the Russians are back at the negotiating table. Yesterday, Lavrov was in Paris, and there will be more and more diplomacy. And when diplomacy and negotiating takes over, you know, from where we were a few days ago, I think one has to pay tribute to what our diplomacies and our multilateral diplomacy did. My third point is that most of those Eastern European countries that have been mentioned, you know, back in the 1980s, 90s, or, you know, today, Georgia, Moldova, Ukraine, you know, they are asking us, the EU, and possibly NATO, to take them in. We have never particularly encouraged them to come and to become member states very quickly. It's exactly been the opposite, in particular the EU, you know, telling all those countries, oh, but we cannot go that far. So we are trying to respond to demands from countries that want to democratize and become less dependent on Russian harebrained policies. So I think today we can be quite positive that today we are really, you know, watching a multilateral positive negotiation. And I think Russia will have to be discussing with us, and it's excellent.
Okay, now, can we just talk about this diplomacy, Johnny, and what Britain might do as part of it? Because this chap with the perfect Mandarin name, Hugh Powell, was snapped, wasn't he, with a briefing paper saying that actually Britain was going to talk tough, but it wasn't going to, never mind boots on the ground, there was going to be no embargo if that affected the City of London in any way.
Yes, I thought it was a hugely revealing moment. I mean, inadvertently, he's walking into Downing Street carrying papers. When are they going to get the memo that if you do that, you have to put them in a folder? Otherwise, a guy with a long telephoto lens will read them. In fact, some people, when I wrote about this earlier this week, said on Twitter that they thought it was deliberate and it was a conspiracy to make sure, a clever leak, so, you know, ensuring maximum deniability. But those papers revealed that, yeah, whatever action the EU mounts, we will demand an exemption for the City of London. We can't do anything that might hurt our bankers and fund managers in the square mile. And I think, you know, it was all of a piece. I mean, it was confirmation that when it comes to British foreign policy, in a way, the number one national security interest in the eyes of this government is the interest of the City of London. And it's happened before. You know, George Osborne, almost to the day, actually, a year ago, going to Brussels to fight valiantly to defend bonuses.
Because
there was about to be legislation from Europe that was going to put a bonus cap, and he said this was a terrible intrusion. And then 6 weeks ago, Osborne made a speech, his first real intervention in the debate about Britain's membership of the European Union in terms of the referendum in 2017, to say that the Lisbon Treaty would have to be renegotiated because he had seen that it was possible for the Eurozone countries to pass legislation inhibiting financial services, and that could hurt the city. So, you know, if ever there was a way of telling Vladimir Putin that, look, you know, whatever we're going to do, it's not going to be that tough, it was through Hugh Powell and that piece of paper, because it said that we're not going to do anything that hurts our own City of London. And that is the problem the European Union have, unlike America, that trade between the European Union and Russia is intense. And that, as Putin himself said in his press conference this week, if the European Union tried to put sanctions on him, he can hit back just as hard, because it is a mutual relationship. You know, 40% of Germany's domestic energy supply does come from Russian oil and gas. So it's easy, in a way, for Obama and Kerry to talk about sanctions, because they have a much weaker, thinner set of trading relationships. And for Europe, it's much harder. And I think the combination of that, the intense European trading relationship, and the fact that Russia is a nuclear-armed member of the permanent member of the Security Council, means that, in effect, Putin can more or less do what he likes.
I mean, of course, that is a big difference. There's always differences between these cases. But finally, on Ukraine, Seamus, I just wanted to ask you, if we take a step back from the specifics and think about the British reaction, so a few years after Iraq, we had a sort of rather reluctant consensus to go for action in Libya in the House of Commons, and then in Syria, a messy but ultimately successful move on the part of the Labour Party to stop it. And this week at PMQs, we had a very dull, but maybe that's no bad thing, agreement between leader of the opposition and the Prime Minister that everyone should appeal for cool heads. Do you think we're into a different era now in terms of what Britain tries to do with foreign policy?
Well, definitely. And I think that's a very positive thing. I mean, you know, as I was saying, I mean, we've had one intervention after another, which have had disastrous consequences, which have, you know, been illegal, have been outside the United Nations resolutions, some with no resolutions, have led to hundreds of thousands of deaths. And I think, you know, what happened in the vote on Syria is an important recognition that those wars, particularly the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, have demonstrated the limits rather than the extent of Western military power. And it's been part of the situation that has allowed a more multipolar world to start to emerge in the post 2008 period.
Were you disappointed Ed Miliband took the sort of anti-Russian position of Cameron, didn't challenge that?
Well, I think, you know, there is a tendency of the main British political parties, as in most countries, to support a kind of bipartisan foreign policy position. And that's the case. I think there should be more independence about it. But, you know, to be fair to the Labour leadership, they did when the crucial vote about attacking Syria came up. They, in my view, clearly went the right way, and they reflected public opinion. They reflected the experience of the previous decade. And there clearly has been a violation of sovereignty in Ukraine. So, I think we are seeing an overall recognition of the failure of what has been a disastrous period in modern Western history.
Okay, well, I think we'll leave that there before we open up Syria as an entirely separate discussion. So my thanks to Seamus Milne, to Jonathan Friedland, and to Marie Mendris. The producer is Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.